You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and with me is co-host extraordinaire, psychologist, Dr. Melody Fox.
And each week, we will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain you while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future.
Melody, I want you to know that I am truly happy you're here with us each week, and I appreciate you taking time away from your practice in Newport Beach.
Well, thanks so much, Alan. It's really an honor to be here, and I appreciate you bringing on board to join you for Answers for the Family.
Well, I mean, each week we're going to address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more.
With each of us having over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, we've been both fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are working to make this world a better place for all of us.
And we will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family.
And today we'll be talking about a new way to understand and break addiction. Now, Lance M. Dodas, M.D., Dr. Dodas, is currently a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute and an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He has also been the director of a substance abuse treatment unit of Harvard's McLean Hospital and director of the Boston Center for Problem Gambling. Now, the Division on Addictions at Harvard Medical School honored Dr. Dodas for distinguished contribution to the study and treatment of addictive behavior and has been elected as a Distinguished Fellow of the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry.
And Dr. Dodas is also the author of two books that have been described as revolutionary and groundbreaking for understanding the treatment of addiction. The first, The Heart of Addiction, and his new book, Breaking Addiction, a 7-step handbook for ending any addiction. Dr. Dodas, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to come on and to talk about this. And I think before we went on, as Melody said, we're really interested in the fact that you have something that's new. So, I mean, what is your new understanding of addiction?
Well, many years, addiction has been treated in more or less the same way in this country. And we know that we don't do a great job in treating addiction. Everyone knows that. So I thought it was time for something new. And over many years of talking with folks with addictions, I recognized that there was a pattern in the way that addictions worked in them. So maybe the easiest way to describe that is to give you a very short story, if I may.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I was seeing a man who had alcoholism. And at the time of this vignette, he had been sober for about 6 months, and he came in one day and he said, "Well, Doc, I blew it. I drank yesterday." So I said, "What happened?" And he told me this story. He said he and his wife had gone downtown the day before, and they were going to do different things. So he dropped her off and he parked the car, and then they were going to meet later at a certain spot at a certain time. Well, he showed up, but she didn't. So he was standing there waiting and waiting and waiting. And as he waited, he got more and more frustrated. And finally, he said, he spotted a bar across the street and down a block, and he went in to get a drink. So that was the story. And I said to him, "Well, did it help to get a drink?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Tell me, when did you first start to feel better?" And at first, he started to say, "Well, I was drinking." But then he caught himself. And he said, "You know, when I first started to feel better was when I ordered the drink." And I said, "Huh." And then he thought some more, and he said, "Actually, I really started to feel better before that. I started to feel better when I walked in the bar." I said, "Huh." And then he thought some more, and he said, "You know, when the very first time I started to feel better, it was back when I was standing on that street corner, and I decided to go get a drink." Well, this is just one vignette, but I've heard this from so many people over so many years that it clued me to the fact that something had happened in that moment, that key moment when he decided to get the drink. This is before there's any alcohol in his system, of course. So what is it? What had he accomplished?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we talked about it, it soon became clear. What he was feeling on that street corner was utterly helpless. This was in the days before cell phones. He couldn't call his wife. He didn't know where she was. He couldn't leave because she didn't know where the car was. He had parked it after he dropped it off. He was just stuck. And the more stuck he felt, the more frustrated he felt. But when he decided to get a drink, he was no longer trapped. Now, you could say, of course he was still trapped in the same situation, but not emotionally. Emotionally, he was now out of the trap because he knew he could and would do something that would make him feel better. He was in control of his life again.
So he was practicing self-care at that moment?
He was not doing a very good job of practicing self-care.
No, well, I mean his decision to do that, but it seems like he was trying to take care of that feeling of overwhelmed at that moment.
Well, that's exactly right. And so that's what I discovered is the first step, the first piece of my idea about addiction, that addictions are efforts to reverse a sense of overwhelming helplessness.
Okay. Now, what I was going to say, it also sounds like what you're saying is you're kind of going away from that whatever people that have said that it's much more something that is chemical. It's something that's in our body that we can't control. You're saying
Before I go on, there's some other parts of my idea, but let me address that first. Part of the confusion is that we use the word addiction in several different ways that are very different from each other, but we use the same word. So that causes a lot of confusion. There is, of course, something called physical addiction. Physical addiction is a simple process in which your body reacts to certain chemicals, like alcohol or heroin, by becoming adapted to them. So that what happens is if you're taking a dose of a drug like heroin, if you keep taking the same dose, eventually your body becomes tolerant to it, so you don't get the same effect, so you have to increase the dose. That phenomenon is called tolerance, and what happens is once you're tolerant to a drug, then if you withdraw the drug, your body is still expecting it to be there, so you get a reaction. And the reaction is always in the exact opposite direction of the effect of the drug, because your body has been balancing it. So most of these drugs are sedatives. They put your central nervous system to sleep, basically, like heroin. So you get an excited reaction, and you might have you have goosebumps, you have diarrhea, you might shake, and you have seizures. All of these are typical withdrawal symptoms, depending upon the drug. And so that's what physical addiction is.
Right.
But the key thing is that physical addiction is not really important in the problem of addiction. It can be a serious medical problem. But the reason it's not important is that we know how to treat physical addiction. It's actually very easy to treat. And you can just put somebody in a detoxification center, or sometimes people detoxify themselves by themselves. They get off the drug. And once you're out of the detox, you're no longer physically addicted. But we all know that doesn't cure the problem. People
right.
leave detoxes in. So physical addiction is not the issue. But it is another use of the word addiction, and that's part of what's confusing. There is another confusion also that's been popular in the recent years, and that is the idea that addiction has to do with the way drugs work in your brain. And we've probably all seen the beautiful four-color pictures in Newsweek showing where in the brain it lights up when you take a certain drug, mm-hmm. and the dopamine release and the nucleus accumbens, all that stuff. The reason that's all true, by the way, but the reason it's not important is because that describes how drugs work, but they work that way in everyone. And the question for addiction is not how the drugs work, but why some people use them compulsively and others do not.
Mm-hmm.
So you really, it doesn't, I mean, it's useful research to find out where drugs work and how they work, but that's not what addiction is about.
Right. I have a feeling that I think along the same lines as you. It's like, what's the precipitating factor? What is the emotion or what triggered that first desire to have that drink or that drug or what have you? What was going on before that they felt better once they made a decision to take that drug of choice?
Yes, exactly. And that is exactly right. So even though people are all different and every occasion is a little different from every other, the basic commonality of it, whether it's a drink or it's a non-drug addiction like gambling or sexual addiction, or eating or shopping, they all have the same thing in common. And by the way, people regularly shift from drug addictions to non-drug addictions, so it shouldn't be a great surprise that they all have something in common.
Right, but, and then you're looking at the behavior is still the same. Addictive behavior is addictive behavior no matter what the addiction is to.
That's right, and so that's right. So it's always a response to helplessness. But then, if I could just for a moment get back to my man on the street corner.
Sure.
So we figured out that what he was doing is he was reversing his helplessness. He was re-empowering himself by going to get a drink. Okay, but the next thing was, I said to him, look, you've been trying hard to stay abstinent, and you've been doing a good job. It's been 6 months. So let me ask you this question. At that key moment, when you felt like having a drink, did you have an internal debate? Did you say, you know, gosh, I really want a drink, but, well, I'm trying not to drink, and did it go back and forth? What was it like for you? And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, what he said, actually, I can't say on the radio, but what he said was basically he said, I said, the hell with it. I'm going to have a drink. Those weren't his exact words. But anyway, so I got very interested in that. What did he mean, the hell with it? Sometimes people say, screw it. What mm-hmm. did that mean? I mean, here's a man who'd been working so hard to stay abstinent, and he just says, the hell with it? Well, it was clear that he was angry. This was an angry thing to say. I'm going to do it no matter what. Get out of my way kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if he was so angry, really enraged, why? What was he so angry about? Well, that one didn't take us that long to figure out. We knew he had been helpless. And one of the things we know about people is if you are totally trapped, like you were trapped in a cave-in, you know, you might try to stay calm, but pretty soon you're going to be yelling and screaming and hitting the rocks. You might even break your wrist trying to get out. But you've got to get out. And there is a kind of normal fury in situations of utter helplessness. So this man was enraged. He was enraged about being helpless. So the second part of my idea, there are three parts to this idea. The second part is what drives addiction, what gives addiction that furious power is rage and helplessness, which in itself is not abnormal. But once you feel overwhelmingly helpless, then that follows from it. And by the way, addictions, of course, are horribly self-destructive, but it's useful to remember that if you were really trapped in a cave and you broke your wrist trying to hit the rocks to get out, no one would say you're self-destructive. And it really is like that. People are doing whatever they need to do in that moment, even though the results are disastrous, because nothing else matters at that moment to them.
Now, before you move on to the second one, I want to go back to the first part about the key moment about addiction. Why is it so hard to find?
Oh, well, okay. Well, this is... Okay, now you're into my new book, Breaking Addiction. Yeah, there's a whole chapter. There's a whole chapter on why it's so hard to find. Sometimes it isn't hard to find. The key moment can be the moment that you first think about it, like this man on the street corner. If we were talking with him trying to figure out what that key moment is, we wouldn't have that tough a time, and he wouldn't either. He would say, well, it's the moment it first came to mind. But sometimes it's tricky because people keep that moment out of their awareness.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in one of the case stories in Breaking Addiction in the book is a man who also had alcoholism. But what he did was he was trying to decide where to go shopping for something at a store. And he had two possible stores he could go to. One of them was at a mall, and the other one was about an equal distance away. And he thought to himself, well, I'll go to the one in the mall. So consciously, it was, you know, six of one, half dozen the other. But really, the reason he chose the one in the mall is because right next to that store was a liquor store, and he was going to get a drink. So for him, the first moment that you'd want to locate that heads you down the path toward addiction, he wasn't even aware of. So he would have had to be... to realize that he made that choice for that reason. And the reason it's so important, as you suggested, the reason it's so important to identify the key moment is because then you look backward from there. What was just happening that led you to need to have the addictive behavior?
And, you know, I would imagine that would take a little bit of digging in session or what have you to, okay, I went to the mall, I went to that one instead of that one. There, you know, it was right there. Oh, and then while I was there, I just happened to be a liquor store next door. So, yeah, of course, yeah, I picked up a bottle of liquor on the way home. And it was convenient, whatever. But unconsciously, right. You're saying that, oh, between the choice, somewhere in their psyche, they were thinking, oh, there's a liquor store over there, so I'm going to go over to that mall because it's closer to where I want to go next.
Absolutely, but it's not conscious at the time.
Right.
Of course, it could become conscious, but at the time it wasn't. And one of the things that, you know, that person or anybody would need to learn about himself is that this is the kind of rationalization that he creates for himself. But once he learns it, then he's going to be in a far better position to predict, you know, when he's heading for a drink or whatever the addictive behavior is.
Yeah, and I'm sure you found this, and I've found it in my own practice, the resistance of that awareness, that they will rationalize all around it. I mean, they will weave their way around, you know, getting to that truth because they don't really want to own it or see it. And I think my clients that they do, I praise their courage to actually take a look at that because it can be scary to look at that sometimes.
Well, yes, and, you know, one of the things I think that people regularly do is they defend something that they feel they have to defend. In this case, it's their addiction. So they'll fight tooth and nail because they don't really want to give it up. And you can understand it if it's doing something for them.
Right.
And you know, the strange thing about addiction, not only addiction, but a lot of other symptoms, is they're all destructive, but at the moment, they are doing something for them.
Mm-hmm.
So what you really want to do is help folks to see exactly what it's doing for them so they can find other ways out. And that's what a lot of I talk about in Breaking Addiction is once, you know, yes, part of the book is identifying the key moment and how you can keep the key moment from you, but then also what do you do when you're in the key moment?
Right.
And then, you know, finally, is there a way to even avoid having the key moment so that you never even get close to your addiction, and at that point the addiction is broken?
And that goes back to your first step of the key moment or finding out what that is. And then you were getting into the second part of your...
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm up to part three already. The first part was that the purpose of function of addiction is to reverse a sense of overwhelming helplessness. And the second part is that the drive in addiction, and what makes addiction so powerful, is the rage at helplessness. So the third part is this. Again, just going back to my man on the street corner. So we knew this much about him, but that still left one important question. Why did he have to have a drink? I mean, if we think about it, he was on that street corner. He felt trapped, yes. He was enraged at being trapped, yes. But, you know, was he really helpless? The answer is no, he wasn't helpless. What he could have done is he could have left. He could have just said, well, she's not here, tough luck, I'm going home. Now I'm not frustrated. Now, why didn't he? Well, he didn't for perfectly good reasons. He loved his wife. He didn't want her to be abandoned. He didn't think it was the right thing to do. So he had reasons not to do it. But the point is that if he had taken a more direct act like that, or any of a number of other direct acts that he could have thought of, he wouldn't have had a drink. So drinking, or addictions in general, are all what I call displacements or substitutions. They are substitutions for taking a more direct action to deal with the helplessness trap. And because they are substitutions, that helps to explain the common phenomenon of people shifting addictions, which otherwise we don't have a good explanation for. But the reason people can shift from, let's say, drinking to gambling, and by the way, about 40% of compulsive gamblers have alcoholism, so it's a very common shift, but even shifting from things like drug use to other compulsive symptoms like cleaning the house, how can you do that? Well, the answer is all you've done is shifted the displacement. So instead of doing this act, you do that act. But it serves exactly the same purpose.
And some are more healthy to do than others.
Right.
Absolutely. Some are more dangerous to do.
Yes.
But the and of course, we'd all hope that the people we're trying to help are doing less dangerous things.
Right.
But the issue is the same.
Mm-hmm.
So it helps if you're treating somebody or people are thinking about themselves. It helps to track things. You know, track their behavior. I had a woman who was addictively using some pills, and she stopped using them, and she came in to me, and she said, well, I stopped using them, but unfortunately, I'm going crazy. I said, why do you say that? She said, I can't stop cleaning my house. I'm cleaning it with a Q-tip.
Wow.
So was she going crazy? No. We figured it out pretty quickly. I mean, it was obvious. She had just changed the displacement. So instead of taking drugs, she now is compulsively cleaning. but the issues were the same, and the basis for it was the same. So, you know, that's it's another reason why the chemical model of addiction doesn't really work very well in real life, because, you know, to the extent that it applies at all to drugs, it wouldn't apply to all these other things. So, you know, it helps to understand addiction better this way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we have a question coming in along those same lines, coming in via email. And again,
yeah.
I want to thank all the listeners when they take the time to do this. This one says, does internet addiction fall into the same category as addiction to food, drugs, and alcohol? And then they have a second question that follows up with that, and it says, if I take away the computer from my 16-year-old daughter that I think is addicted to it, will she gravitate to some other form of addiction?
Yeah, okay. Well, the answer to the first question is yes. People can addictively use. I don't like the term addicted to, because addicted to sounds like you're magnetically drawn to it. Actually, what it is that you select, not necessarily consciously, but you choose the displacement, something that you can use for this purpose. So yes, you can use the internet, and many people do. Chat rooms, for example, or internet games are popular versions of that. Sure. So that's true. As far as taking away the computer from your daughter, you know, it depends on whether this is truly an addiction or, you know, especially with computers and teenagers, it's so common that it not be an addiction. There's a lot of overuse of things, drugs and activities, among teenagers that is an addiction, so it's a little hard to say.
Well, it's kind of like having a teenager that, you know, on my age, you were on the telephone until you fell asleep on the phone. So, you know,
that's right.
And now they're on the computer, emailing all their friends, instant messaging all night.
And the social networks.
Right, that social connection.
Checking on their 4,000 friends to make sure that everybody's okay.
That's right. As a matter of fact, you know, I write a blog for the internet site of Psychology Today magazine, and my latest blog, which I just put out yesterday, is exactly on this topic of non-addiction causes of excessive and repetitive behavior. And there's a whole bunch of them, so it could be that this teenage girl is using the computer for completely non-addiction reasons. Doesn't mean it's a good idea for her, but it may not be an addiction.
Right.
Okay. And so for the person listening, how can they go to that blog and read a little bit more about it?
Oh, well, actually the blog is in two places. So it's on Psychology Today. If you look under addiction, you'll find my blog. My blog is called The Heart of Addiction. But the alternative is that the blog is also on my own website, which is just LanceDotis.com, one word, LanceDotis.com.
All right. Well, there you go. Appreciate you sharing that. And again, for this listener, thank you for giving us that question. And if you didn't get it answered here, go and check it out there.
And we're not done talking here.
No, of course not. No, of course not.
No,
yeah,
really
yeah.
Quiet for
yeah.
a second.
Yeah. In other words, yeah. Don't go right now. Not right now. Don't drop this one to go to there.
No, it's not an internet addiction if you're listening to this program.
That's right.
this is what I would call a healthy one.
Yeah, right. This is a healthy one. Right.
Well, yeah, I know you write about some short-term strategies when the addictive urge is upon you. Can you tell us about some of those?
Sure. One of the things that you can do, this man on the street corner was one example. I mean, he could have left. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an obvious, simple thing to do. I'm not suggesting he should do it. I'm just saying he could have done it. And a lot of these short-term solutions, not all of them, but a lot of them are obvious. They're obvious once you think of them. But folks in the throes of their addiction don't think of them. And there are several stories in the book about this. In one case, for example, a similar kind of situation, I described the case of a young man who was who felt overwhelmed whenever he was trying to buck his the group pressure of his friends. It was very reason that I go into in the when I explain it about him. He became very anxious when he was going to defy the wishes of others around him. So he was at a baseball game with his friends, and they all wanted to leave in the middle because the home team was losing, and he didn't want to leave. But what he noticed was as soon as they said, Let's leave in the sixth inning, he had the immediate thought, okay, I'll go, and when I get home, I'll have a drink. So since he had thought about this already, he recognized, okay, now I'm at the key moment. I just thought of having a drink. Why? Well, he knew himself well enough to know that this was one of those occasions where he was going along because he felt he had to, and he just told the guys to wait a minute. He thought, he figured out a solution. He didn't have to defy them in the way that was scary to him, but he could just say, look, I'm just going to stay for another inning or two, and it was fine. So this didn't require any great genius. It was an obvious solution. But it's the sort of thing that often can be thought of, just like this man leaving the street corner. But there are other kinds of simple solutions, too. Sometimes you can plan to do something after the fact. It's never too late. In other words, you're in a situation where you have already agreed to do something or found yourself in a situation where you felt helpless. If you even think ahead, sometimes you can figure out a way to solve it in the future or go back and solve it. In another case, there was a man who was in a meeting room, and he couldn't speak up. He was afraid to speak up with people. And when he left the room, he said, you know, I'm going to go off and take some hits of my cocaine. But he stopped, and he said, you know, maybe I was helpless there, but it isn't over. The meeting is over, but it isn't over. Mm-hmm. And he went ahead and wrote up a memo to some of the people in the meeting to say what he would have said if he had had, you know, if he hadn't been too timid to speak up. So those are kind of obvious examples.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, but then there are cases that aren't so simple. And I describe, in Breaking Addiction, I describe a man who in his case, it was heroin. He used heroin whenever he was faced with a serious loss. And that had everything to do with the serious losses he had faced earlier in his life, to which he was very sensitive. So on this occasion, his girlfriend was breaking up with him. And she did break up with him. So now, what could he do? This was a case where it wasn't like saying, I'm going to stay another inning at the ball game. This is a case where he couldn't get her back. There was no way he could talk her into returning. He had tried that before. So he truly was helpless. What could he do to get out of this helplessness trap? Well, for situations like that, a lot depends on knowing yourself well enough to have some perspective on it. If he had thought about this in advance, he might have been able to predict that he would be upset when she left him, if she left him, because he knew that was his thing. You know, mm-hmm. He can't be left. So it doesn't ease the pain of it. He was going to have to deal with some grief at the loss no matter what. You can't change the reality. But he might have been able to say to himself something like, look, the issue for me isn't just that my girlfriend just left me. The issue for me is that I can't stand being left, which is not the same thing. So I can't do anything about her leaving me, but I can have some perspective on my sensitivity to being left. And by sensitivity, what I mean is not only does he have a strong reaction, but he has a reaction based on his past. So, yeah, he can't do anything about her, but that's completely different from the issues that made him sensitive to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
The reason he's so sensitive is because of very serious losses he had suffered, and that he needed to work out. But even though he experienced the current loss as if it were another serious loss, it really wasn't.
Well, it's all those underlying issues that are going on. I mean, a lot of times we try to work in the present, but then you really do have to dig back to the past sometimes and figure out where that first occurred so you could learn some different ways to deal with that pain or that loss, as you're saying, or those feelings of helplessness that arise again and again in your life that precipitate that key moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's also, my experience with it is that people actually can solve their addiction much sooner than they can solve all the rest of the troubles in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to get it all worked out. You only have to have some perspective on it.
Right.
Right. And that's from a short-term standpoint. From a longer-term standpoint, using your example, I mean, would it be something to start working on this person's level of self-esteem? Maybe if their self-esteem is built up, they're not going to feel as hopeless at the time in which that person leaves them.
Well, I think that ultimately, yes. I mean, ideally, for somebody like, his name is Gil in the book, but somebody like Gil, Who had suffered all these losses. Absolutely, he needed to work out all the feelings and all the way it changed his view of himself to have been left. No question about that. But even before that, the kind of longer-term solution to the addiction is that once you know the theme that is your vulnerability, once you know what kind of thing is liable to tip that off, you can almost always anticipate it. Sometimes, not just hours or days in advance, but sometimes weeks or months. There's a woman whose case is in the book who felt she was obliged to give parties for people all the time. It was just part of her sense that this is what she should do for other people. She had a kind of sense that it's the morally right thing to do to keep on entertaining people, even if it meant destroying her own life because she didn't want to do it. Well, once she got clearer about this, even before she worked out all of what was behind all this, she could now predict, and we could both predict. We could sit together at a time like now in April and say, you know, you've got a party planned for August. You've got an end-of-summer party planned, which you don't want to have. And she would say, yeah, you're right. I've done it again. So she now is so far in advance, she's not going to do her usual thing, which is have the party and then take her pills, which is what she had done. What she can do now is she can say, okay, I know exactly when I'm going to next feel the urge to take these pills. Maybe it'll be before then. But in any case, on that occasion, I can tell 4 months in advance I will have the urge to use pills. I can tell you the date and the time, you know, which is kind of an incredible thing to be able to do. So with that much advance notice, she's not feeling any urge now. Well, she can plan. She can change the party. She doesn't have to have the party. She could do it differently. She could have it catered. There are 1,000 things she could do that will deal with how she feels. And she'll know when she's done enough because she'll be able to tell how she feels about it. And at that point, when people can anticipate all the occasions on which they will feel the addictive urge in advance, they've essentially broken the addiction. Even before, and I'm not saying you shouldn't work this out, of course you should, but even before you get everything worked out, the addiction, it doesn't have to be a symptom in your life.
Right, so basically becoming more cognitive on what the triggers may be so they can make a different choice before enacting the old behavior.
To know the kinds of things within them. I mean, some of these are concrete issues like I'm going to have a party, but they also may be things like Gil's sensitivity to being left. In his next relationship, it would be wise for him, and there's another case in the book that's like this, to start thinking early on, how is it going? And, you know, even while things are going great, if this relationship fails, what am I going to do about it?
Yeah.
And so you can avoid the stage of having the urges, which we all know are the toughest point.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break. We are talking with Dr. Lance Dodis, and we are talking about addictions. We will be right back. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. All right, we're back and we're talking with Dr. Lance Dodis.
And he is a specialist, of course, in addictions, and we are so happy to have him here today. And he's got a brand new book out, which is, which is just wonderful. It's a new way to understand and breaking addictions. And we did have some listener questions today, Dr. Dotus, and we wanted to make sure we got to them. And one of them I have here, it's, my father and my two brothers have been serious alcoholics most of their lives. And during my 20s, I found that when I drank, I had the same propensity to crave more than just one glass, and then turned into a very negative person when I was drunk, just as I observed in them. So I stopped drinking when I became pregnant 18 years ago and have been literally afraid to drink at all because of what I considered a hereditary chemical problem. What is your observation or experience with this type of problem?
Well, you know, that's a good question. One of the other things that we hear about a lot is people discovering a gene for alcoholism. I like to say they discover it so often that it makes you wonder how they keep losing it. But here's the story on genetics. The genetics of addictions have been extensively studied, but by far the most carefully studied has been alcoholism. So if you look at all those studies going back about 50 years, it turns out that there is some genetic influence for some people with alcoholism, but it's not possible to actually inherit alcoholism. I know this is vague, but that's because the data is vague.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something that may help. If you look at two people who have the same genes, identical twins, they have exactly the same genes. If one of them has alcoholism, the odds are that the other does not. That's just statistically. So that gives you a sense of the role of genetics. I mean, true genetic diseases where you can actually inherit a disease, that would be impossible for, because they have the same genes. How could you not inherit it? So if you had a real genetic disease like PKU or any of the other genetic diseases, you know, if you have it, your twin will have it.
Mm-hmm.
So it just doesn't work out that way. There is some genetic influence, but no one has been able to find anyone how it works. And the current thinking is that, first of all, it doesn't apply to many people. And for those that it does apply, there may be literally hundreds or even thousands of genes that contribute to this. So it's not the sort of thing that you can just inherit. It's a complex matter, which is what you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
It's also true that the genetic studies have been deeply flawed by a certain problem, which is that if you understand that addictions are the same as other compulsions, then in order to study them, what you would have to do is look at all of the people with this condition. And that's never done. They narrow it down to people, say, with alcoholism, and they're missing all the people who, let's say, have compulsive gambling, but who have exactly the same problem.
Right.
So I'm afraid the genetics are just not that clear or useful, but I suppose it should be good news to this woman that you can't inherit it. So, and by the way, the one kind of alcoholism that where there is has historically been felt to be more of a genetic inheritance is a few cases of kind of a male pattern alcoholism, which pass where their fathers and sons. So as a daughter, she would not be in that group anyway.
Well, I'm just curious, too. I mean, they're talking about the father and the brothers have always been drinking, and she kind of drank along with them. So I'm wondering how much of it is environmentally learned. You know, routine becomes a habit, and then it becomes an addiction. What are your thoughts on that?
No, absolutely. And I think that identification is an important thing, too. For example, we know that if parents are compulsive gamblers, that they are more likely, for non-genetic reasons, their children are more likely to be compulsive gamblers. It's a pattern of identifying with what your parents do, and that certainly is true for drinking, too.
And the same thing for cigarettes. They've shown that if parents are smoking, they could tell their child, don't smoke, but they're more likely to at least experiment with smoking.
Right.
If they see their parents do it.
Right. Yeah, we have another question along the same lines that came in that says, I believe addiction is not just a problem with alcohol and drugs. As a teacher, I see a tremendous problem with my students in general food intake. I believe they are addicted to sugar and fast food. Over half of my 14 and 15-year-old students are classified as obese, and I never see them in the halls without some candy bar or can of pop in their hands. What are your feelings about this area of concern?
Well, it's a very, very serious area of concern. It's interesting, in my hometown here in Boston, sugary drinks were just banned from public, city-owned facilities. Look, it's a major public health problem. I'm not sure that makes it an addiction. You know, if we could get all of those sugary things out of the vending machines in schools, we would all be better off. And, you know, 30 years from now, we're all going to save on medical costs because these people won't be developing diabetes and heart disease and cancer and all the other things that are now known to be associated with sugar. So it's a major problem. I don't know if it's really an addiction. Mm-hmm. And this gets back to the first point that people do things for all kinds of reasons, and kids are especially vulnerable to going along with the crowd. And
right.
you know, if you're the only person who says sugar is bad for me, and you're going to get laughed at, you're not going to be standing on your own too long.
Well, and I've got a question in regards to enabling and such. Now, the odds are that most of the people that are listening to the show are not necessarily the ones that are actually addicted to something, but more so might be the ones who are enabling. What can you tell those people that are in that situation? You know, at what point do they go to, quote, tough love? You know, where do they make that decision when they're with a loved one who they think is addicted to something?
Yeah, it's another very good question. I actually address that specifically in Breaking Addiction, both enabling and tough love. Here's the thing. If addictions were responsive, were modifiable according to what happens to you when you do them, then no one would have an addiction. The whole point of them is that people with addictions aren't dumb and they're not blind, so they see that their lives are being ruined. It doesn't affect it. So that being the case, it doesn't make any sense to, for example, to have tough love. I mean, first of all, the tough part suggests that it's almost sort of a punishment. You know, we're going to be really stern with you. Well, there's no reason to be stern. I mean, this is not badness or evilness or immorality. It's a compulsion. So that part doesn't make sense. And besides that, it doesn't modify the behavior. So I'm not in favor of tough love. That doesn't mean that you can't talk to people. I think you should talk to people. I think that the more open communication you have, the better. And, you know, you shouldn't be biting your tongue either. You should say, look, you know, if it's your spouse, you say, I'm very worried about your whatever it is, your drinking or whatever it is, your gambling, and we need to take it seriously. And you need to do whatever you need to do to protect yourself. All of that is true, but that's different from tough love.
Right.
And enabling mm-hmm. is the other side of tough love, and it makes really just as little sense. I mean, if you... Here's an example that I put in the book. Let's say that that you're the wife of a man who has alcoholism, and he doesn't get up for work because he's hungover. So he says to her, look, would you call in sick for me? Okay? And he does this fairly often. So if she calls in sick, then she is presumably enabling him.
All right.
But what does that mean? She's making it easier for him to drink? What if she didn't call in? Well, one way or another, he's still going to drink because it doesn't, you know, if it mattered to him that he was going to lose his job, then it wouldn't be an addiction. He could just control it by willpower.
Right.
And besides, what's better for them? Let's say she doesn't call in. Let's say he now loses his job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now she has a husband with alcoholism and no income. That really doesn't help anything. So I just think that these ideas are simplistic and they're not really helpful. Besides that, they can be harmful. Because people feel obliged to not, you know, quote, enable. And I've seen any number of parents, for example, who are tortured by the idea that they, you know, I have a son who's living in another city, he's on the streets, he wants us to send him money, we know he's going to use it for drugs, what do? We don't want to be an enabler. Well, they shouldn't feel guilty about that. Of course they want to help their son. And if their son were to die on the streets, they would feel terrible the rest of their lives. So it's not a question of what you ought to do. It's a question of what makes most sense to do.
And, mm-hmm. and allows,
in cases like...
I'm sorry, go ahead. And allows...
Oh, I was just going to say, and in cases like that, what I usually say is, look, send him enough money so he can find shelter and food, but not more, and tell him that he has to get into treatment, and tell him you will pay for the treatment, but you will pay the doctor or the clinic directly, and that's it.
Right.
And you're not going to let him die. And don't worry about being an enabler.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Now, and to take that a step further, because I know the love of my life yesterday, we were watching television and we saw something that came on about shopping addiction.
Yeah.
And the thing we thought about from an enabling standpoint is that they were dealing with the woman who said that she had a shopping addiction, but she was right there with her husband, and when they showed a clip, he was shopping with her. So he would go with her and go shopping.
Yeah.
And so at what point do you say, you know, wait a minute, at least I'm not going to go with you. I'm not going to continue to make this a fun event for you.
Sure. I mean, that makes sense. But that, sure. I mean, there's some things that are just sort of straightforward, but I wouldn't think of it exactly in terms of enabling or not enabling. I would say to him, if you are concerned about your wife's shopping, then sure. You know, say to her, I'm concerned about your shopping, so I'm certainly not going to go with you, but not to give you tough love or to enable or not enable. I'm not going to go with you because I'm opposed to the whole thing. I think it's bad for you. I mean, that it's just based on that.
Right. Well, it's kind of giving them a natural consequence. If they want to go, that's fine, but they go on their own because I'm staying at home and I'm watching the football game.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, on which hopefully I'm not betting.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to deal with my addiction while you go deal with your addiction.
Right.
Exactly. You know, I know we have another important question that came through, and I want to make sure we ask it before we run out of time here.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've got about 5 minutes.
Okay.
This question came in, and again, it came in this morning, and it says, how do we know if our 15-year-old son has an addiction to pornography, or is it just being very curious? And if so, how do we stop it?
Well, the diagnosis question is always a little bit tricky. And unfortunately, to really answer it properly, you have to get to know the person. Mm-hmm. You can't tell from outside. Right. And this is like the question about the daughter also is a similar issue. I don't know, and I don't think anyone can know unless they talk with this boy and get to know him. And what you're looking for is, if it is an addiction, then it is something that is compulsively driven, and he is doing it because it solves an internal problem for him. He's anxious, let's say, at school, or he's worried about his development in some way, or whatever it is. When he gets those feelings, he has to watch pornography, and it's a compelled activity. That's an addiction. But, you know, there are lots of normal 15-year-old boys who watch pornography for normal 15-year-old boy reasons.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
So it's very hard to say, and one of the things I often caution parents about is, do not be quick to tell your child that he has an addiction, even if he does, because once you say it, if you're not right, then you're going to be tuned out after that.
Right, and they're given a label then, but my thought is, does it interfere with their daily functioning? Does it interfere with their social networking, with their schooling, with their work or their family? And that, to me, is when it becomes a big issue.
Well, that's right. And also, that's, you know, I think that even though it's not absolute, because there are things that hurt you that aren't addictions.
Right.
But if you are doing something that is, this boy is on the internet all the time, so he's not making friends with people or he's not doing any other activities, then the question I would have for him is, how do you feel about missing out on all these other things? And maybe if he trusted me, he might say, I don't like it at all, but look, you know, this is something I got to do. Well, that would pretty much define it for me. He would be saying, you know, I got to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So that would look more like an addiction than, let's say, either habit or normal curiosity.
Yeah, well, I know we only have a couple minutes left. Is there anything that you'd like to take a moment and wrap things up for us on what you want to make sure that we get across today, other than the name of your book? And
well, I guess the main thing I would want to get across is that what I started out saying is that our treatment for addiction has not been very successful overall in this country. And I'd like to get across the idea that there's now some hope that we haven't had before.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't really understand how addiction works, and by and large we haven't as a culture, it's very hard to treat it. You know, you can do your best and mean your best, but if you're not understanding how it works, it's just not likely to be very much help. And people get very discouraged. And the related thing is, when you do understand how it works, most of the people that I've talk to don't feel nearly as ashamed as people often do with addiction, because they see it for what it is, as an attempt to manage feelings of being overwhelmed, which we all have at times, and it's just one way to do it. So it doesn't make you different from the rest of humanity.
And Dr. Dodis, thank you so much for joining us today for Answers of the Family. Go on out, check out his brand new book, Breaking Addiction, a 7-step handbook for ending any addiction. And also you can check out his blog on Psychology Today, which is a great website. I might be a little partial here. And you said it was under The Art of Addiction?
Yeah, The Heart of Addiction.
The Heart of Addiction. Okay. And also LanceDodes.com, LanceDodes.com.
Yep.
And they can also check out your blog there. So, again, thank you so much for joining us on Answers
for
the Family.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.